You know what the Senate health care bill does by now, I would guess. You will be amazed, my friends, to hear what it doesn't do. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, the 22nd of June. Glad, as always, to have you with us, everybody. Okay, we have got, at long last, the no-longer-secret Senate health care bill. The specifics, I'm sure you've heard, sharp and sweeping cuts to Medicaid, more power to states to decide what insurance plans have to cover. It shrinks the Obamacare subsidies. But there is one big thing it is simply not going to do, and that is make health care cheaper. From the Health Desk at the WHYY Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein gets us going.
When people talk about lowering the cost of healthcare, they're talking about things like drug prices and hospital stays.
There's nothing in this bill to make healthcare actually more affordable.
Bob Kocher was a special assistant to President Obama and worked on the Affordable Care Act, or the ACA, which was also criticized for not doing enough to lower health spending. The truth is, bending the cost curve is hard.
The ACA's effort to bend the cost curve was the most ambitious amount of curb bending that we could pass through the Senate.
Vanderbilt University economist John Graves says you can get a sense of how Republicans think about reducing spending right on page 6 of the bill. That's where the bill lays out how some low-income people could get access to insurance for the first time.
What this bill actually does is would basically allow them to purchase a catastrophic health insurance plan at about 2% of their income.
Since the election last fall, conservative economists and policy wonks have fantasized about catastrophic insurance. The theory, and it is a theory, is that when consumers have more skin in the game, they'll spend less of their own money, driving down total health spending over the long term. And when you look at the Senate bill, it's full of ideas to reduce benefits and shift costs.
So in a sense, this is an approach to bending the cost curve. But what it really is doing is just eliminating spending.
That's UCLA law professor Joe Horwitz. Horwitz says there's nothing in this bill that directly tackles prescription drug prices or reins in inefficient hospital care.
It's as if you said, I spend too much on my housing. And instead of doing things like making your house more energy efficient, you simply don't live in a house anymore.
But now that the bill is out, lawmakers are likely to hear plenty about what people do want. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
There was an interview on another public radio program today, which shall remain nameless, but whose initials are Morning Edition, in which Congressman Tim Ryan, Democrat of Ohio, was asked how his party can start, in essence, getting its mojo back. Here's what he said.
Well, I think having an economic message, I think it's figuring out how to rebrand ourselves at the national level.
So we asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer what it might look like if the Dems change how they talk about the economy.
It's the economy, stupid. You may remember that as the theme of President Bill Clinton's campaign. Stan Greenberg was Clinton's pollster. He says Democrats have lost that laser-like focus on the economy, and President Obama spent too much time talking about how the economy had improved since the financial crisis, not showing enough concern for those left behind. Greenberg says that really annoyed voters in his focus groups.
They were, like, physically really upset and wanted to attack the moderator, you know, when they would hear about the 200,000 jobs that had been created in the last month.
Greenberg says that's because they knew those jobs didn't pay enough to live on. In an email, the press secretary of the Democratic National Committee told me Democrats are making progress organizing around issues like health care. Consultant Jenny Backus is a former Democratic Party strategist. She says Democrats should reach out to people who would lose out under the Republican replacement for Obamacare.
It's a new generation of people who can speak about the differences between the two parties for people's bottom line.
Senator Sherrod Brown, an Ohio Democrat, recently unveiled a more than 70-page proposal of populist pro-worker ideas that Democrats could use as a blueprint.
The role that government can play in raising wages, direct investment in infrastructure so that people can go to work in jobs that pay a livable, living, good wage.
And Brown says he'd be willing to work with President Trump to accomplish his goals. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Today in G, global capitalism sure is an interesting beat. The news that Qatar Airways, the government-owned carrier of that much-in-the-headlines Persian Gulf country, is going to plow $800 million into American Airlines. It's an unsolicited investment. They're just going to buy shares on the open market like the rest of us. It's a move apparently not entirely welcomed by American management. And as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains, it's also possibly not entirely about the money either.
U.S. airlines, including American, have bitterly criticized Qatar Airways and other carriers in the Gulf over alleged unfair competition. They charge those governments subsidized ticket prices, undercutting U.S. carriers on routes to the Middle East, Africa, and the Far East. Seth Kaplan at Airline Weekly says the Gulf airlines have a pushback.
They say the U.S. airlines are hypocritical because there are other airlines around the world that are state-owned that the U.S. airlines don't criticize.
But Gary Huffbauer at the Peterson Institute says the evidence in the skies over the Middle East is pretty clear.
Anybody who's flown these airlines knows fares are quite reasonable. Comfort is great, and they have taken a tremendous amount of market share from U.S. and European carriers.
Huffbauer says investing in American is a way for Qatar to say, we support you financially, let's not fight, but work together instead. American Airlines is having none of it. CEO Doug Parker said in a letter today the company isn't excited about Qatar's investment and will keep fighting companies that are, quote, illegally subsidized by their governments. There's another level of geopolitical play here, says Stephen Cook at the Council on Foreign Relations. Qatar's in a fierce fight with Saudi Arabia and its Gulf neighbors.
This is something that the Qataris have done in the past. They have made big investments in the United States as a way to insulate themselves from criticism.
But Cook says American policymakers pay more attention to what Qatar's doing in the Middle East than in the U.S. stock market. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Might as well have taken the day off on Wall Street today for all the difference the trading session made. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. So with the Senate bill out and being analyzed to within an inch of its life by the relevant interested parties, we figured we would get one of those parties on the phone and see what's on his mind. Peter Lee is the executive director of Covered California. That's California's Affordable Care Act health exchange, the first such exchange, by the way, created after the bill became law back in 2010. Peter, thanks for coming on the program.
Great to be with you, Kai.
What's it been like for you the past, five, 6 months since the inauguration, trying to run essentially a healthcare business with the uncertainty in healthcare policy that's going on?
Well, we've actually seen here in California that we have 11 health plans participating in the individual marketplace, and we have a lot of stability because we've made things work for consumers and for the health plans. So it's been relatively stable. But around us is a huge amount of froth and churn that we're trying to navigate.
Explain that a little bit, would you, the froth and the churn? Because as I'm sure you know, the healthcare bill from the Senate came out this morning. There's the House version that's going to have to be reconciled. And there is so much that you can't possibly know about how this is going to go.
Yeah, there's a couple things. First, right now, we're sitting down negotiating for 2018. And health plans have been uncertain if they're going to get paid a major part of a subsidy from the federal government called cost-sharing reductions.
Mm-hmm.
So in California, we said, let's take it off the table. We've given the plans a way to build the cost into their rates and make sure the federal government still pays for it. So there are ways to negotiate and navigate these choppy waters. But on some levels, what we're seeing right now with the Senate bill release is very choppy waters coming down in the future for millions of Americans.
What do you make of the Trump administration, which obviously wants Obamacare to go away? What do you make of it, the policy decisions that it has made so far about cost-sharing subsidies and about other things that seem to put Obamacare in deliberate peril?
Well, there's a number of things this administration has done, which in some ways are encouraging health plans to leave the market that's already unstable. At the same time, I want to give a tip of the hat that Secretary of the Treasury and the IRS has issued a policy saying they continue to enforce the mandate. And this is the law. And I think that's what we all as Americans need to hold them to.
The mandate, of course, being the individual insurance mandate that was part of the Affordable Care Act. And we should say here that you worked in healthcare in the Obama administration. What is the best case for you in the next 6 months to a year in healthcare in this country?
The best case is for the next 6 months is, remember, there are millions and millions of Americans that have coverage today that did not 5 years ago. But also, millions of Americans have the peace of mind that if they get sick and they've got health insurance, when they show up, it's still there for them. So the last thing we want, I think anyone, is to go back to the bad old days of healthcare where you had an insurance card, but whoops, sorry, we don't cover cancer. And that's the prospect of what we're seeing right now with the Senate health bill.
Is that what you're anticipating then, that some version of the Senate or the House bill passes and these changes come to pass?
I'm not the right guy to game. Are they going to get 50 votes? If it does, millions of Americans are guaranteed to lose coverage, and millions more are going to be facing coverage terms that are a lot more onerous than they have in the past. And that's one of the main things I think we all need to look at is the CBO next week is going to come out estimating the impact of this bill. And they're going to look at how many people are going to lose coverage. But all health coverage is not created equal. And a key question we all need to look at is, are we going back to the days of skimpy benefits, meaning people have coverage in name only and can't get access to the care they need?
Peter Lee, he runs Covered California. That's the Affordable Care Act's California Health Exchange. Mr. Lee, thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Okay, Kai, thank you very much. Have a good one.
President Trump promised during the campaign a whole bunch of times, in fact, that he wasn't going to cut Medicaid as part of getting rid of Obamacare. Senate Republicans confirmed in their bill released today that they are okay with hundreds of billions of dollars of cuts to the program for low-income Americans and people with disabilities. Anticipating those cuts, a lot of states have been slipping down their own programs, Arkansas among them. Arkansas Public Media's Sarah Weitz-Kotichek has our story.
Willie Freeman works in the meat department at Food Giant in Little Rock. He's 54 and has been insured through the Affordable Care Act for 4 years.
Yeah, all the time. Yeah, I use it all the time.
His job pays $9 an hour, too much for him to be on traditional Medicaid, which covers low-income people, and too little to be in the healthcare exchange. Because Arkansas opted to expand Medicaid to fill the gap, Freeman was able to start going to the doctor.
I had my left leg was kept paining for some reason, like it had a burn in it. And I thought it was like my blood wasn't, you know, going through my body right. And I went to the doctor and they said it wasn't nothing. It was like I pulled a muscle or something.
Now Governor Asa Hutchinson is scaling back the state's Medicaid expansion program. It looks as though Freeman will earn too much to stay on the plan. Hutchinson is lowering the income threshold for the program for working people and creating new work requirements for enrollment. The governor explained the changes at a press conference earlier this year.
You will see more people working and signing up for work and worker training, and you'll see cost savings to the state and cost savings to the federal government.
He needs to make those cuts because Congress is looking at proposals to lower federal Medicaid match rates to states. But he says about 60,000 Arkansans would still be able to get insurance through the federal exchange. That's assuming Congress doesn't significantly cut subsidies for the poor. Eddie Pinnell is retiring executive director of Little Rock's low-income Harmony Health Clinic. He doesn't think Arkansas's plan is going to work out well for many low-income people.
That reminds me of a song. Fairy tales can come true. It can happen to you. I don't believe it.
Pinnell says depending on what happens in Congress, federal subsidies might not cover the costs for people like Freeman if they lose Medicaid coverage. He says people who are moved out of Medicaid expansion and into the exchange will have higher deductibles and new penalties if they miss paying a bill.
And we're seeing them now coming back to the clinic that got in there, paid their first month premium, their car broke down, they got to fix their car in order to get to work, and they didn't pay their premium the next month, and they were kicked off of the exchange.
Under the Affordable Care Act, about half the clinic's uninsured clients were able to get coverage. In fact, Arkansas was one of the states that saw the greatest drop in uninsured residents nationwide. Joe Thompson is a health policy expert who informally consults with the state legislature. He says Arkansas's plan is a middle-of-the-road Republican compromise, emphasizing personal responsibility.
I think it's politically easier to say we're helping people below the poverty level, but not those above the poverty level. I think it clearly saves the state's money.
Arkansas has seen more than $3 billion from Medicaid expansion over the last 4 years. The program's continuation is now critical to the state's budget plan. In Little Rock, I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotichek for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You see the same rocks that were described in Lewis and Clark's journals.
Economic geography, you could call it. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 12 today, less than a 10%, closed at 21,397. The NASDAQ up 2 points, less than a 10% there as well, 6236. S&P 500 basically flat, 2434. American Airlines up 1.1% today on that news about Qatar Airways. Mitchell Hartman was telling us about Delta, up 1%. United Continental down about 0.1%. The renewable energy company Sunrun Incorporated rose 1.9% today. Others in the solar panel making business were sunny side up as well after President Trump's vow to put solar panels on top of the still unfunded border wall. SunPower Corporation up 13%. Brookfield Renewable Energy up 0.5% today. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell 2.14%. You're listening to Marketplace. Hi, everybody. It's Kai Rizdahl. Marketplace is in the final week of fundraising before our books close for the year. We're asking you to step up and help support us today so that we can continue the in-depth, independent economic coverage you rely on. Any amount, even a small donation every month, counts. We appreciate your support. So please give today at marketplace.org/donate. And thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There's a bank branch office opening in South L.A. later this year that wouldn't ordinarily be such a big deal if not for which bank it is. City National, here in Los Angeles, is informally known as the Bank to the Stars. It's got 30 local branches, most of them in high-end enclaves like Brentwood and Bel Air. But the banking business in South L.A., mostly low-income, almost entirely Black or Latino, is totally different and a deeply needed proposition. Marketplace's Aaron Schrank has more.
City National's branch office in Beverly Hills overlooks the Rodeo Drive luxury shopping district, where Bentleys and Range Rovers compete for street parking. From right here, the bank began 60 years ago, building its reputation as the go-to lender for the entertainment industry. CEO Russell Goldsmith, a former movie executive himself, says its founders were filling a void.
Los Angeles needed a bank that would reach out to a community that was not well served by the biggest banks.
Its status as Hollywood's banker was further cemented when the bank famously put up the ransom money for Frank Sinatra's kidnapped son. Since then, it's expanded its base of wealthy clientele beyond showbiz and beyond L.A. But the branch coming to South L.A.'s Crenshaw District will be one of just a few local branches not found in wealthy white neighborhoods.
This is really, to some people, a bit of a surprise to bring a private and business bank into the Crenshaw District, but we think it makes good sense.
One reason, something called the Community Reinvestment Act, or CRA. That law requires banks to prove they're serving low-income and minority borrowers. In 2015, when City National wanted regulators to approve its merger with Royal Bank of Canada, it beefed up its CRA commitment, pledging $11 billion in products like mortgage and small business loans. A Crenshaw branch can help it achieve that goal. On a recent afternoon, I meet Hassan Nicholas Del Campo outside of what will become City National's South L.A. branch. It's a strip mall storefront, currently occupied by a payday lender.
If you just took a casual walk around in the neighborhood, you're not going to see a lot of representation by financial institutions, right?
Del Campo works for Rise Financial Pathways. A report from the nonprofit lender counted just 16 banks here, in an area where 500,000 people live. That's just 10% of the national average. To make things worse, the number of payday lenders here, 64.
And they just kind of go hand in hand with low-income communities.
The one right in front of us charges 460% interest rates on two-week loans. Still, we see plenty of people walking through its door.
Those services are needed. There just needs to be some type of balance.
In opening a new branch in an underserved area, Georgia Tech professor Dan Immergluck says City National is parting ways with most banks.
The trend has been towards closing branches in general and closing branches, particularly in lower income and minority neighborhoods.
Since the recession, banks have closed more than 6,000 branches and cut small business lending by 20%. He says the CRA was passed 40 years ago to prevent those kinds of things.
But the law has been tepidly enforced. Basically, there was a de-emphasis of CRA during the Great Recession. Banks were under really less close observation.
City National's commitment is making a lot of people happy. Paulina Gonzalez at the California Reinvestment Coalition says the bank sat down with community members and hammered out a strong deal. But she says in a neighborhood where a new rail line is bringing all kinds of new development and displacing longtime residents, there's worry the money won't go where it should.
City National, just like any bank, is going to have to ensure that the lending it's doing is serving the current small businesses that are located there and not just those new businesses that want to come into the area.
But with specific goals for small business lending and other services in its CRA pledge, Gonzalez says the bank has a blueprint to make sure that happens. In Los Angeles, I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
All right, so enough healthcare policy and banking regulation. How about some great outdoors, huh? Since his election, President Trump has developed an interest in this country's national monuments, and he's ordered Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke to look into how much those lands ought to be protected or whether they should be opened up for economic activity. Inside Energy's Dan Boyce reports from the Upper Missouri River Breaks National Monument in Montana. It's about 400,000 acres that are under review.
So we have here a story about a small bit of language that led to a big change in north central Montana. The American Antiquities Act of 1906 is only 4 paragraphs long, and just one of those paragraphs gives the president power to set aside land of historic or scientific interest as a national monument.
We could just stop up here.
Matt Knox takes me up to a bluff on his family ranch.
We could be meteorologists this spring because all you have to say is that there's a 100% chance of wind.
Parts of that land in this expansive view intersect and overlap with the Upper Missouri River Breaks National Monument. It was protected for its place in history and its rare ecosystem at the very end of the Clinton administration in 2001. The Breaks is exactly that, rough, broken land, deeply cut by the winding Missouri River. Think Western movies, bone-dry gorges with a few stands of evergreens. Right now, the land still holds on to this soft blue-green hue of spring. Knox has been opposed to the national monument status from the start. He says he and other ranchers want to manage this land as they have for generations without so much government oversight.
We cuss the county commissioners, we cuss the state legislature, we cuss the governor, and we reserve most of our cussing for the federal government.
He'd like Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke to shrink the footprint of the monument. He says the Antiquities Act is supposed to protect specific sites, like the Statue of Liberty or Gettysburg.
The original intent was not to set aside huge swaths of land.
He'd be okay with protecting, say, just the famous sandstone White Cliffs or important Native American battle sites. River guide Nicole Fuser says that's too narrow.
I think that's really important to find a place that is as it was and is unchanged. And that is the Missouri River.
She owns Missouri River Outfitters and paddles tourists in canoes to ancient rock drawings, remains of teepee camps, and historic vistas.
You go down there and you see the same rocks that were described in Lewis and Clark's journals.
Fuser worked summers here for years and bought the guide business a few months ago. She's now part of the state's multi-billion dollar tourism economy. She's afraid of the area losing protected status. Chris Mell directs research at a Montana firm called Headwaters Economics. He looked at 17 national monuments in the West before and after federal protection. He says the local economy's diversified and expanded.
All net new jobs are in services. The federal government considers that everything from healthcare and accountants and lawyers on the higher paying end to folks who work in a hotel or the tourism industry on the lower paying end and many things in between.
Meanwhile, the number of people in agriculture is shrinking, with or without national monument status. Back on his property, rancher Matt Knox just wants to hold on to his way of life. His worst-case scenario, the Upper Missouri River Breaks goes from national monument to national park.
We don't want to be an inholder in a national park and flip hamburgers for people. That's not what we do. It's not who we are.
He says scaling back the monument would send a signal that ranchers like him will have a future in the area, working the land. I'm Dan Boyce for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, quantification from the good people at Bloomberg Government of the breakdown in civic order in this country. They noted that members of the House have set a record this year for violations of the House rule that says members are not allowed to basically make disparaging remarks about the president. The rule has been broken, presumably by Democrats, 48 times this year. It was broken, presumably by Republicans, 46 times in the last Congress. In case you long for the slightly more civil days gone by, in 2001 and 2002, that is the first full Congress of George W. Bush, zero violations of that rule. All right, that's it. We're done. That's all we got. The Dow off 12 today, less than a 10%. NASDAQ up 2, less than a 10%. S&P 500 down 1. We'll call that flat because it pretty much is. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Troh are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor, I'm just going to let that hang there, interim managing editor is John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.